leaving Fila alone with the two priests and the bloodied remnants of their companion. So easy to issue a score of death sentences, Fila thought. The queen did not feel afraid. She felt alive. That is why you will do as I say, she said, not through fear for yourselves, but because of my promise that if you don't, everyone you love, or have ever loved, will bear the responsibility of your refusal. The priests looked terrified, and Fila saw thoughts and fears turning and rolling behind their eyes. Your sweet sister, her children, her grandchildren, she said to Per Garin. Your dead brother's family, she said to Per Ristolo.
You're no queen, Per Ristolo said.
Fila offered a tight smile. You'll die, Per Garin said. Magic will destroy you as it destroyed your mother.
No, Fila said. It won't.
In their eyes, she saw that they believed that too. Queen Fila followed the two priests down into the depths beneath the Temple of Four. They had stepped over the body of Per Ostvik, and she had seen how both high priests averted their eyes. She had not. It was good to take ownership of one's deeds, however brutal and unappetizing they were. She would not deny what she had become, nor what she was destined to become soon. She reveled in it. At the foot of the circular stairwell was another room with a similar pattern inlaid in the floor. The priests followed the pattern, and she followed them, until the floor whispered down into another descent. Per Garin carried a torch, and at the head of the second stairwell, Per Ristolo took a lamp from the wall, lit it, and held it toward Fila. Without a word, she took it. The old priest grunted. After the second stairway, Per Garin led them into a roughly carved tunnel. Per Ristolo followed, gesturing Fila to bring up the rear.
I've a story to tell you, the ancient priest said.
I don't want to hear your old tales, Per Ristolo.
Nevertheless, I'll tell it. And if that offends you, have your murderer cut my head in two and spill my brains. I'm sure she's following. I'm sure your majesty would not venture somewhere so dark and dangerous alone.
Fila smiled at Per Ristolo's broad back. She had heard no sound from behind, yet she knew that Shome and several other silent were there. They had spoken about what would happen, and the assassins would be at home in these dark secret depths. What might happen when they went deeper and drew closer to the places these priests haunted, the caverns and holes where the dregs of old magic rested? She did not know. That was a problem to confront when it happened, but not one to distract her from her course of action.
Many years ago, when Lartha was little more than a rough settlement of traders and hunters at the river's edge, and the nation of Quandis had no name, there lived a woman called Mephilia Bonn. These were simpler times, when people hunted to eat, farmed to live, and war was a waste of energy and resources. Simpler and more peaceful. Betika, god of wind and war, whispered in the air, and only dreamed of the conflicts she might preside over in the distant future. But Mephilia Bonn came from a nameless island of the Outer Ring, with a purpose in mind.
Let me guess, Fila said. She wanted to steal magic from the gods, and she paid a terrible price.
Per Ristolo coughed something that might have been a laugh, but he did not look back. They were heading along a slowly descending tunnel, turning gently left and right and bearing ever downward. They passed junctions with other tunnels and openings into pitch-black caves where things scuttled and scratched, and Fila had to trust the priest's sense of direction.
I'm telling the story, Majesty, Per Ristolo said. In a way, though, you're right. but in another, very wrong. It wasn't Mephilia Bonn who paid the price for her transgressions.
They reached a small room with several doors leading off. Per Garin paused for a moment, looking left and right. Then she grunted to herself, nodded, and headed down another tunnel. Per Ristolo and Fila followed.
Mephilia Bonn thought herself a whisperer.
Fila drew in a sharp breath, but Per Ristolo kept on talking, no inflection in his voice, no hint that he was trying to goad or lead her into some admission of her own secret pastime. That word, though.
She spoke to the animals, guiding and cajoling them, supposedly encouraging them to perform tasks for her. True or not, I can't say.
The priest coughed another laugh.
Probably she fooled herself, but that didn't stop her from offending Daphine, god of water and beasts.
How did she offend her? It's just a story, Per Garin said from up ahead. Her shadow twitched and danced in the flickering torchlight.
Stories are what we're made of, Per Ristolo said. This one goes, Mephilia Bonn built an altar in a place south of where Lartha now stands, and there she sacrificed 6 animals to Daphine every hour, every day, for a whole year. Birds, rats, mice, spiders, squirrels, and rabbits, deer, wolves, and any other creature she could find trap in slaughter.
Honoring Daphine, Fila said. It's done today in some parts.
Honoring Daphine by building her likeness in dead animals,
Per Ristolo said.
60 feet high, a stinking mountain of rotting creatures that Mephilia Bonn announced to be Daphine's given form. It offended Daphine greatly, this false image of her built from the creatures she loved, honored, cherished. She sent a flood along the river to cleanse the land of Mephilia Bonn and her sickly homage.
I've heard about this, Fila said, her voice a whisper. The Flood of Floods.
You've heard the story as told to children, Per Ristolo said. A storming river, banks swept away, villages and settlements carried down the river and into the sea. Truth is, not only did the flood kill thousands and scour the land for 100 miles downriver, but it also washed those 50,000 dead and rotting bodies into its course. Their taint poisoned the river, and many more died from sickness and disease. Daphine was angry. The floods came again and again.
So an angry god lost her temper, Fila said. It's just a story.
One of many such tales, Per Ristolo said. Tales of fools who upset the balance of things.
This way, Garin said. We'll reach the first of the safe places soon. The safe places? Fila asked. Per Garin paused and glanced back for the first time since they'd descended the stairwells. Her eyes looked haunted, maybe angry. Fila would have to remain alert. A place that if you tried to pass on your own, you would die. Fila smiled and nodded.
Like those safe places deep down between Palace Hill and Temple Hill?
Per Garin and the old priest stared at her.
The lake with the tentacled creature, ready to snatch unwary explorers. The rockfall crawling with ghast spiders. Remnants of the fallen first city.
Don't know what you're talking about, Per Garin said. Just do as I say when we get there and you'll be fine. She turned away and started walking again before ending her sentence with, Your Majesty.
You've seen the hill of Clan Dachlan, with its sheer eastern cliffs,
Per Ristolo said, and it took a moment before Fila realized he was continuing his story.
9,000 years ago, Charin, god of fire and secrets, cleaved that hill in two when a man named Jerok started carving that god's secrets in stone for all to see. Countless people died.
Why are you telling me these old tales?
Because I fear your ambition will offend all the gods, and that one day when the land has recovered from the gods' wrath, survivors will be telling your story in hushed, fearful tones.
Foolish old man, Felis said. I offend no one and nothing. There's nothing of the gods left, other than what you keep to yourselves down here.
There is more than you think.
Then if that's the case, you preach fear of the four to keep people away from what you covet. Maybe it's you priests who are the enemies of Quandus, not the Bajumin who have fallen under the blade. Maybe you've been fooling us all along.
No, Majesty,
Per Ristolo said, not at all shocked by his queen's outburst.
We fool no one but ourselves, by following a royal line corrupted by greed.
Fila felt anger simmering in her, but it was tempered by the weight of the world around them. She felt the whole mass of Quandus pressing down upon her, its new queen taking on the mantle of troubles that her mother had passed down. What she was doing here would make her better able to serve Quandus, and make it the power she always believed it should be. She had to believe that. As Per Garin called a halt, Fila gasped. Something came past her. Through her. She felt a breeze in and around her body, and it carried a smell and taste that reminded her of that tendril she'd inhaled on the balcony of the Blood Spire. She staggered against a wall, holding herself upright as her heart and mind opened to what she was feeling.
Magic.
Per Ristolo offered a wry smile.
I'm fine, she said. Fine.
We can still head back.
I'm fine,
he grunted. Per Garin was performing some sort of ritual at a rock face just ahead of them. Water dripped down the rock, and several small, slimy creatures slicked across the wet surface. The priest muttered an invocation that Fila could not hear, performing several complex patterns in the air with her hands, repeated many times as her voice rose and fell. The rocks before her melted away to nothing, and the slimy creatures dropped to the floor. The priest trod them underfoot as she walked through. Fila tried to hold in her amazement. She could feel the dregs of magic soaring around and through her, but seeing it used like this for the first time was a shock.
Was the rock even there at all? She asked.
If you think it was, Per Garin said. What do you mean? It was a false wall that you revealed? Or your words made the rock disappear?
Whatever you believe, the priest said.
She shook her head as she entered the new chamber.
You know nothing, she muttered.
Words Fila wasn't certain she was meant to hear. She glanced back before she followed the priests, comforted by the sight of several shadows following them far behind. Shome and the other silent needed no light to see. From that point, the journey became something of a dream. Fila followed the priests, trying to concentrate on their words when they spoke, but her senses were taken more and more by the sizzle of power that filled these deep, dark places. It was as if magic was heavier than air, rock, Quandus itself, and its final leftovers from whatever past the land had endured had slumped down here, hiding in the dark and waiting for people to come and find it. Clearly the priests had, over many years, and her mother had also slipped down and drowned in its arcane touch. Now it was her turn, and Fila was determined that with care, she would be triumphant. All her life had come to this. She heard whispers of voices far away or long gone, singing songs of the past. She tasted exotic taints on the air, food she had never tried,
wines from places no one knew, the sweat from muscled bodies. She smelled the future and saw herself standing atop Palace Hill, with the entirety of Qandis laid out before her, worshipping and honoring her as not only Queen Fila, but the greatest queen the country had ever known. The Eternal Queen. In her mind's eye, day and night flitted past. The Temple of Four crumbled to ruins as she became the tallest part of the land, and hills rose and fell before the endless span of her rule. Water flowed along the river, and sometimes it turned to blood. Fila absorbed it all, always remembering who she was and what she had done. That was important. Her sense of self would preserve her, and once she had returned to the surface, the priests would prepare her to slowly, carefully immerse herself in the magic that filled this place. Deep, dark magic hiding away no more. Time passed and Fila found herself poised at the edge of a wide, low cavern. Water filled it, coming to their knees. It was ice cold. She glanced back, but there was no sign of Shom, and a sliver of fear stabbed into her heart. Terror flittered at the edges of her perception. Per Ristolo and Per Garin looked older than they ever had before, but they were both smiling at her. "You wanted this," Per Ristolo said. "Behold, the Four." "The Four?" Fila asked. She didn't understand. She looked across the chamber, and at its center was a wide raised area, an island in the pool, behind a veil of water cascading from cracks in the ceiling far overhead. The island was only inches above water level. At its four corners, 200 feet apart, were four enormous stone pedestals. They looked like giant slumped stalagmites. They had form, long, almost circular, unspectacular, and yet. "The tombs of the Four," Per Garin said. "Here?" Fila asked. "No. No, they're not real. They're not here." "They're as you see," Per Garin said. "Each acts as a foundation to the towers far above, at the corners of the Four Square. Very much here. Very much in the real world." Neither priest spoke again. They knelt and worshipped, and Fila felt herself dropping to her knees in the cold water, through shock rather than a need to pay homage. Though at first glance there was nothing special about this place, Fila knew that it was the center of the world. "I've seen," she said. "Now, just gently to begin with, I must touch." Chapter 11. Blaine felt the world tilting beneath his feet. He felt punched, winded, and tears began to well in his eyes. From the bare safety of shadows 30 feet from the edge of the water, he watched Queen Fila kneel, and everything he had ever believed began to crumble around him. Pressure in his chest and the flushing of his cheeks forced his body to remember it needed air, and he made the tiniest gasp for breath. Across the cavernous chamber, one of the silent stiffened and glanced his way. "Not now," Blaine thought. "I can't die now. So close to truth. So close to freedom." The silent tilted her head as if listening for the beating of his heart across the darkened grotto, where darkness and light danced together, and lanterns were supplemented with strange shafts and pools of illumination whose origins were unclear, perhaps uncanny. His heart beat a thunderous rhythm, and he pressed his eyes shut, trying to quiet it. He knew that the silent were only human, but also knew that they were masters at the art of killing. He opened his eyes, expecting her to be there in front of him. But she had not moved. The silent was small and thin, her long red-brown hair braided down her back. Flashes of silver came from the thick braid, winking in the torchlight, and it took him a moment to understand these were razors knitted into her hair. Apparently, though, the braided assassin had heard nothing. The prayers from the pool grew louder and drew her attention, and at last Blaine allowed himself to exhale. He felt a rush of wonder as he stared at Queen Fila on her knees between Per Ristolo and Per Garin, and at the four stone shapes that rose from the corners of the wide platform at the center of the vast chamber. More water trickled down from above, curtains of light rain that cascaded down through the crevices of the city's bedrock, fed by the river or by leaks in Lartha's aging plumbing. "You're thinking of plumbing," he thought, chiding himself. But really he was not. Blaine thought not of pipes, but of age. The 7 or 8,000 years since the founding of Qandis, when the first city had fallen and the city of Lartha had been born anew. Thousands of years of secrets, but they all led here. And the fucking High Order had known all along. They had been keeping the presence of these four tombs to themselves. Blaine pressed a trembling hand over his mouth to keep the cries of anguish and awe inside. The four did not exist. The god of the Bajuman, the god of his childhood, did not exist. Magic did not exist. And yet he had seen the phage, and the warping of the air that showed the passage of energy when Per Ristolo had used spellcraft. Even then he had tried to persuade himself that was still of the natural world, the power merely something the rest of the world had not yet interpreted. But this was different. In those raised tombs, surrounded by the cascading rains of the city's cellars, Ansalam, Batika, Charin, Defeen. Since the first day he'd come to Temple Hill, he had done all he could to learn the secret paths and hidden corners, both in Yaris Teague and in the Temple of Four. Per Garin had tracked him down a day after the Bajuman slaughter began, to tell him that Per Ristolo had gone to see the Queen, but Blaine had been below the temple then, exploring for the first time. When at last he reappeared, she demanded to know where he had been. He told her that he'd been hiding, in fear for his life. Per Garin, notorious for the sharpness of her tongue and the withered black thing she called a heart, had shown him sympathy, but she had also reminded him that he had nothing to fear. He was no longer Bajuman. Her comfort had infuriated him, because it dismissed the murder of his people and all the sins that had come before. Per Garin had been kind to him because being a priest erased what she considered the shame of his birth. In the shadow of that moment, he had redoubled his efforts, keeping watch over those he knew were members of the High Order, particularly Per Ristolo and Per Garin. There were dark looks and conspiratorial whispers over the course of days, and he began to eavesdrop when he could. When whispers among the teachers at Yaris Teague had suggested the Queen had made her way up Temple Hill, Blaine knew he had to risk everything. So once more he had slipped into the cellar and through the subterranean tunnels that led up the hillside, crept into the Temple of Four, and made his way into the Elders' Corridor. At the end of the corridor he had listened at the door, and heard the Queen's threats against Per Ristolo and Per Garin. Only after they'd gone had he dared to slip into that blue room, with its shifting lights and sea-glass mosaics. There he had found the corpse of Per Ostvik, in a bloody tumble partway down the spiral staircase. Heads split, brains spilled. And then he'd done the most foolish thing of his life. Even knowing a number of silent were with Queen Fila, he had followed. Courage and idiocy had merged into one, and yet something else tugged him along, some gentle lure, a whisper not in his ears but inside him. Inspiration, he'd told himself, still afraid to really believe that any other influence might linger in the buried places where ruins of the fallen first city were still visible. He'd seen Per Ristolo and Per Garin wave away the strange creatures, heard the words they'd chanted to smooth their passage, saw the truth of the wall whose barrier existed only in belief. He shouldn't have been able to duplicate those gestures, those words, that belief. Not without practice, not without magic. And yet he had. The high priests began to undress. The urge to avert his eyes weighed on him, yet he watched Per Ristolo unveil his wrinkled flesh and studied Per Garin's sagging bosom and stick-like legs. All the ferocity and authority of his high order instructors bleeding out with their dignity. There was a certain austere beauty to their ancient bodies, but he knew he would never see them again without imagining this moment. Together they undressed the queen. Blaine had never seen Fila before, and he had never imagined being this close to the former princess, now monarch. Her skin seemed to reflect the shadows and light of the cavernous chamber, exquisite in her nakedness, perfect in her lines and curves, her face full of wonder and joy. Nevertheless, Queen Fila radiated a sense of command. It was as though all of them had merely been making their way into her domain, a home she had lost and to which she had now returned. Blaine felt the animal urge to touch her, what some would have called the song of Daphine, but it clashed with the song of Batika, the urge to kill. He resisted both and watched as the two High Order priests bathed themselves and then the queen. They cupped their hands full of water and drank from the pool surrounding the slightly higher level that had the tombs at its corners. They never drew closer, never even passed through the curtains of water that fell from above. Those cascades seemed now to almost be a veil that separated the tombs from those who worshipped what might lie within. Hello? He thought, directing his thought toward the tombs. Are you? No, he would not. If gods he had never believed in were wielding some influence over him, toying with him in some way, he would not reach out to them. He almost laughed aloud. Even with all this evidence before him, he still had his doubts. He was pulled from these thoughts as a strange ritual began. Per Ristolo called upon Charin and presented a spark of fire in the palms of his hands. Per Garin called upon Batika, and a gust of warm, sweet-scented wind swirled and eddied through the cavern, extinguishing two of the lanterns. Together they called upon Daphine, and again cupped the water, pouring it over Fila's head, slicking her hair down. It was Fila herself, instructed by the priests, who searched along the bottom of the pool and found a sharp-edged stone. She slashed at the palm of her left hand, kissed the stone, and hurled it past the veil of water, and made a fist and let her blood drip into the pool. Wind and war, fire and secrets, water and beasts, earth and love. The four. The words chanted by the priests were an ancient tongue, a guttural series of strange syllables that felt somehow familiar to Blaine. He recognized it as a language written down in obscure books inside the Temple of Four, but he had never heard it spoken aloud. Still, he felt the tug of it, the music in it, though on the surface it sounded so ugly. "Kneel once more," Per Ristolo said, placing his hand atop Fila's head. "In obeisance," said the queen. "Not at all, Majesty. You kneel so that you don't fall down." Per Ristolo shot a warning glance at his fellow priest that Fila didn't seem to notice, but Blaine found curious. Each of them then placed a hand on one of the queen's shoulders as they reverted to that old tongue. They sketched at the air with their fingers and then reached out their arms, heads hung, palms upward. Blaine felt it first inside the cage of his chest. The bones vibrated, his heart clenched, and then all sound vanished from the vast chamber. The sheets of water cascading from above made no noise as they splashed into the pool. A quiet had descended over them, unlike anything he'd ever known. Blaine could no longer even hear the beating of his own heart. The pool lit up with eddying currents of light, bright sapphire ripples that spread out from the tombs and their wide platform. And when Blaine blinked, he could see these ripples also in the air all through the cavern, as if they'd been there all along. At once, the ripples in the air washed together like waves crashing, washing over the three worshippers in the pool. Queen Fila, Per Ristolo, and Per Garen. The queen laid her head back and cried out, the first sound in what felt like forever. Her voice heavy with sorrow and yet tinged with the gasping surrender only ever born of ecstasy. Blaine shuddered. A thrill of pleasure went up his spine, and though the ripples of light did not touch him, he thought he felt some of that magic in himself. Then it was over. The High Order priests helped Queen Fila shakily to her feet. She stumbled between them, and the Silent moved in close as the three of them dressed. In what felt like only moments they were leaving, the priests whispering to their queen and she keeping her own counsel, except to tell them, breathlessly and flushed, that they would return the next day, and the next. When they tried to dissuade her, she warned them that she would not be denied. "My birthright," she said. "I feel it even now, in my blood. In their blood."
"Your mother,"
Per Ristolo began as they all retreated back the way they'd come, through the first of a series of snares and traps and magical defenses meant to keep away all but the High Order themselves.
"You let my mother kill herself," Queen Fila snarled.
Her body spasmed, as if in pleasure, and she grabbed the arm of one of the Silent.
"She was muddled with Spiza, blind with it. I am not so weak."
"You said you would be cautious. Careful."
"You priests will care for me and be my caution. But I cannot wait. Not now. Not after."
The words became muffled after that. Only when they had all left did Blaine let himself exhale. Lanterns still burned. Uncanny lights still glowed, although the sapphire ripples in the pool and air had faded to nothing. He still felt the crackling static of their presence. Blaine knew he should leave, and he was worried. If he could not remember the words and gestures, never mind the precise turns and steps and the hidden passages, he would be trapped down here until the High Order priests returned with the queen. Pray for whatever might stalk these silent, mysterious places. Yet his mind was a sponge for knowledge and information, an ability exercised daily through his studies in Yaris Teague, both aloud and covert. This place and everything he had seen was what he had been seeking all along. So he did remember. Every phrase, every gesture, every step. And not just to escape, but for the ceremony he'd just seen performed. He stepped from his shadowed grotto and walked slowly toward the pool. His heart ached as he gazed at the tombs, and he considered the myths he had been taught about magic, the control of the elements and the summoning of ghosts, premonitions, and manipulations. He remembered tales of how magic bound the magician to the land, so the health of one could be tied to the health of the other. So many stories. Yet which were true? He had always been a hopeful skeptic, though that had now changed. In that cavern ringing only with the sound of falling water, Answers niggled at the back of his brain. He stared at the tombs through the veil of water, wondering what those ancient, desiccated gods looked like now. Dead for thousands of years, their power still lingered, the remnants of it coalescing here almost as if it had been waiting. He stepped into the pool and began to disrobe. Book 2 Chapter 12 A fortnight had passed since Fila had first gone to the tombs. She had descended at least once each day since then, other than the day of her mother's state funeral, a somber affair that Fila had only wanted over, and followed the ritual set forth by the High Order. Per Ristolo and Per Garin watched over her, and with each step in her indoctrination she saw their doubts and their fears beginning to slip away. Her mother had gone mad, muddled by Spiza, believing that she could expose herself to the full array of the lingering magic of the Four and absorb it without consequence. From the beginning, Fila had been more cautious, sipping at it day by day, wary at all times of making the same mistakes as her mother. Lysandra had weakened her mind and body with Spiza, and ignored the cautions of the priests advising her. Though Fila would not be deterred by their hesitations and doubts, she had still instructed them to advise and watch over her. And when they told her she'd indulged in enough magic for one day, that she risked too much, she listened. She was determined that the magic would not unravel her as it had her mother. Sitting in her high seat and gazing upon those gathered in her audience chamber, she wondered if they could also see the flickering blue stars that hung about the room. They were small things, but there were thousands of them, winking in and out as they drifted and eddied like dust motes and shafts of long afternoon light. She felt every breath as it inflated her lungs, felt the patterns in the wood and cloth of her chair. Heard the words spoken around her as if each had been whispered into her ears. Heightened by her taste of magic, each moment felt delicious.
Majesty.
The single word floated crisply in the air. Queen Fila breathed deeply as she surveyed her audience. Per Ristolo and Per Garin stood just a few feet from the dais, the appearance of age so deceptive. She knew what lurked within them now, what they could summon if they had the courage, and her own intimacy with magic had only just begun. With those high-order priests stood a third, Per Stellan, one-eyed and broad, with a wild tangle of red hair that marked her ancestors as outlanders. The others were experts in the rituals of their craft, but Per Stellan had been called in from the ring at Queen Fila's command. She knew how to wield magic better than any other, or so Per Ristolo claimed. For a moment, the glistening pit where Per Stellan's eye had once been became a distraction. One of those blue stars flickered inside it, as if the magic rested within. Queen Fila felt a flash of jealousy. She wanted that flickering blue star. She craved every last dreg of magic the Four had left behind.
Majesty, are you all right? Daphna asked.
Queen Fila snapped her head around to glare at her.
You are my voice, woman. You cannot speak for me.
Daphna blanched.
I speak only the words you give me, or the spirit of them, if that's what you desire, Majesty.
Fila smiled. Each breath she took felt like a serpent slithering in and out of her lungs. She glanced at the others in the chamber, the two city guards by the doors, Commander Curtness just beside Daphna standing at attention, her sister, Mirin, to the queen's left, Shom to her right. There were three others silent in the chamber. The smallest was Helene, she of the long red braid, the size of a girl of 13 but deadly with a blade in either hand. Her reputation had caught even the late Lysandra's attention. Idly, Fila reminded herself that she ought to learn the names of the others. These women were closer to her than her own family now. Somehow, almost closer than her own skin. They were all bearing witness to the beginnings of her transformation. They were her armor given life. Her weapons. Her fists. Soon enough, I might not even need them. The thought made her smile as she looked at each of the envoys the Great Five Clans had sent. But she frowned slightly when she saw that some of the envoys had changed. Queen Fila wondered if new ones had been chosen because the others had been ineffective. Or maybe I've already had them killed, she thought. Sister, Mirren said. Let me ask you a question. Sister, Queen Fila said, watching the flickering stars as they swirled in the air. Do you believe I'm unaware that I am making you all wait? That I care at all about your impatience? There was rustling among the noble envoys, but it ceased the moment Fila looked their way. They froze, errant children caught misbehaving. The queen looked to Daphna. An edict from the crown, issued through my voice. Daphna nodded quickly. Relieved to be getting on with it. The royal family is directly descended from the Four. We have the blood of gods in our veins. Thus, as our gods surely intended, the crown and the faith are one, and always have been. This is as it was when the Four built Lartha on top of the ruins of the fallen First City. This is the natural evolution of things. This is the way by which Quandis will reach true greatness once again. From this day forth, Quandis is a holy state, and whoever wears the crown is also the head of the faith. Per Garen swore quietly. Per Ristolo began to cough, his face reddening, as if he might be having some sort of stroke. Per Stellan kept her expression blank, unreadable, and said nothing. The envoys felt no such compulsion to keep quiet, however. Even Mirren gasped, and it was this that drew Fila's attention. She turned to her sister, saw the stricken expression that somehow made Mirren even more beautiful. Shock could do that, Fila knew. So could terror. Something, sister? Queen Fila asked. She watched Mirren's eyes and wondered if she could be trusted. Not from me, Majesty, Princess Mirren replied. But you can surely see that there will be voices raised against this. Fila sat up straighter on her high seat and cocked her head, feeling the weight of the crown shift. She looked from face to face, beginning with Daphna. The voice would not meet her gaze. I hear murmurings from our good nobles and from the priests who serve our ancestors, the gods. Those of our blood, Queen Fila said. But no voices raised in furor. Surely all must recognize the truth of this. Every Quandian knows we are descended from the Four. I have merely decreed that we will follow the natural order of things. She glared at her sister. And I am the queen. You are, Mirren said.
Majesty. Per Ristolo said, clearing his throat and blinking as he caught his breath. In the full history of Quandis, the crown and the faith have always been separate, partners in guiding the lives of our good people.
An error I have just rectified, Queen Fila interrupted.
Surely you'd like some counsel first, Per Ristolo went on. If you'd only speak with Apex Euphraxia.
The weight of her gaze quieted him. She did not need to remind him of the fate of Per Ostvik and his family, or even to have one of the silent move toward him. A pointed glance carried all the warnings she would need. The Docklin envoy stepped forward.
That's enough.
The others seemed split on whether or not to support him. He had weathered, scarred features of a veteran soldier. His hair was receding, and though he wore the finest fabrics, he reminded her most of one of the filthy, emaciated hounds that wandered the back alleys on the lower hills.
Enough? Fila echoed curiously.
You cannot usurp the Apex. You can't seize control of the Faith, especially when Euphraxia is not even here. The Faith is inviolate, our shield from the whims and excesses of the Crown. You can't.
Commander Curtinus moved swiftly for a man of his size. In two steps he had his sword pressed to the envoy's throat.
You're a good man, Yoris Docklin, but you're speaking to your queen. Men have died at my hand for the sort of disrespect you've shown.
Shom and the other Silent had not moved, and would not unless Fila ordered it or she was in danger.
Commander Curtinus, said the queen.
She studied the whirls in the air as the stars only she could see danced and flickered.
Is Yoris Docklin a good man? Truly?
Curtinus did not take his eyes off the envoy.
Yes, Majesty. In my eyes, at least.
Yet you would kill him if I ordered it.
The commander of the city guard nodded grimly.
Without hesitation.
Of course you would. Your flesh was woven with loyalty and courage as the thread. You're precious to the crown and faith. Come, and kneel before me.
Commander Curtinus had been ready for bloodshed, so he hesitated a moment before stepping away from Yoris Docklin. The exhalation of his unexpressed violence seemed to calm the room as he turned and strode to the dais. He laid his sword on the floor before the high seat and lowered himself to one knee, bowing his head.
Now you, Yoris Docklin, said the queen.
Fury roiled behind the envoy's eyes, and Fila could practically see its tendrils shifting beneath his skin. Yoris Docklin exhaled loudly, glancing around as if seeking support for his little rebellion. None was forthcoming. In fact, the envoy from Clan Elster approached the dais and knelt beside Curtinus. One by one, the others followed suit, until at last Yoris Docklin joined them. His fury still raged, and the current of the stars drifting through the room seemed to flow away from him. But he had knelt. Queen Fila turned to the priests.
Now you.
At her side, she heard Mirren's breath hitch. But the three high-order priests were nothing if not wise. Together, they walked toward the dais and joined the others, each on one knee.
Daphna,
the queen said,
you are my voice. You have heard my edict. Go now and speak for me.
The voice bowed her head.
It shall be done,
she said, and scurried off to perform her duties. Minutes passed before Queen Fila allowed those on their knees to rise. She wanted them to feel the ache of their obedience, and never to forget it. The spies at chimneys in Apex Euphraxia's cellar had been scraped clean. Years of rime had left stains on the stone that even bleach could not remove. Deimos knew because he'd tried. With a heavy cloth tied across his nose and mouth, he'd dedicated himself to this task with uncommon diligence. He didn't care one whit about the end result. If the spies at chimney sent poison smoke upstairs and killed everyone in the house, he would have been happy. Deimos's interest in the spies at chimneys sprang from the unique facet of their construction that he'd discovered while cleaning them. If you were quiet, and you chose your position well enough, and you knew which chimney opened into which room, it was quite possible to eavesdrop on conversations elsewhere in the house. The conversations were muffled, sometimes incomplete, sometimes frustratingly quiet, depending on where the speaker might be standing in that particular room. But this discovery had made spying on Euphraxia's household a much simpler task. Not as if it matters anymore,
I know that expression on your face, Mouse whispered.
Deimos shifted, his knees hurt. Though he'd been given other jobs to do, the worst of the scut work, the garbage and grime, he'd kept coming back to the spies at Chimneys under the pretense of determination. His neck and shoulders ached from scraping the stone and from bending to push his upper body into this chimney or that. But his knees were the worst, even with the grass mat that Mouse sometimes managed to sneak to him.
What expression? He muttered. Dejection. You're worried there's no point to spying anymore.
Is there? Deimos asked. Word had filtered down even to the lowest slaves of the Queen's joining of Crown to Faith, and what it meant for Euphraxia. Did Queen Phila even want him to continue spying? He'd sent several short reports out into the city in Tolliver's hands, worried that the boy would never return, and he had been surprised every time the little sneak reappeared. Now what need did the Queen have of Deimos's spying if she had already usurped Euphraxia's power? Give me a turn, Mouse ordered. Stretch your legs. They'd become allies in recent weeks. Not friends the way they'd been as children, but the memory of that friendship had grown stronger. Deimos slumped away from the chimney with a huff.
This isn't the life I thought I'd have.
I'm a sailor. A soldier.
Mouse bumped him with her hip. That wasn't the life you thought you'd have either. He glanced at her. He admired the rise of her cheekbones and the fine line of her jaw, the pale winter blue of those eyes.
What are you talking about?
Mouse smiled, perhaps the first true smile she'd shown him over these long weeks. A flicker of memory touched his mind, her as a little girl. The two of them running and laughing together.
You wanted to be a pirate. Captain Deimos, scourge of the sea, master of the ring.
She chuckled softly, one hand rising to cover her smile, as if worried that her usual grim mask had slipped. Don't you remember?
Deimos leaned closer to her. He breathed in her scent, a combination of rough soap and her own musk that froze him to the spot. Those winter eyes were locked on his. Deimos's body remembered every blow she'd given him, every bit of pain she'd caused. But he knew it was the merest fraction of the pain she'd endured through her life of slavery. She was Bajuman, but she never tried to hide the mark on the inside of her left forearm. Mouse resented her lot in life, but she was not ashamed of it. His own slave's brand no longer hurt, just as the flesh had scarred and settled, and as the days had passed, so too had Deimos himself scarred and settled. He needed to escape this place, but his confidence in the world outside and his place in it had faded. The brand had done that. It had changed him, jaded him. He'd become the lowest of the low, but at least he was not down there alone. Careful, he breathed, not sure if he was speaking to Mouse or to himself. He bumped against her.
Or the scourge of the sea'll order you keel-hauled.
A child's laugh broke the quiet, loaded moment that followed. Deimos and Mouse twisted around to see Tolliver watching them from his usual perch atop a wooden crate at the other end of the spiza chamber. The Bajuman boy moved with stealth that came from instinct. It was how he'd survived to be here with them in the first place. But sometimes it meant he showed up in a room without anyone being aware of his arrival.
You two going to kiss? He asked.
Mouse went paler than her normal Bajuman hue. Deimos stared at the boy, then at Mouse, and wondered at the answer. Princess Mirren had his deepest love. She was his intended and his closest friend. This moment of shared intimacy with Mouse felt like a betrayal. But that insight was only coming to him now, after the fact, and he could not be certain what might have happened if Tolliver had not interrupted.
Let me listen for a while. Mouse said quietly.
You go and keep watch. Deimos nodded quietly. Aching, confused, he began to stand. Then he heard the voices slithering from the mouth of Chimney 3. Deimos held up a hand to silence Mouse and Tolliver. He recognized the angry tone and cadence that had become typical of Euphraxia of late. But the other voice. Who is that? Deimos said quietly, crouching beneath the mouth of the chimney. Mouse crept over beside him and bent an ear. Knowledge sparkled in her eyes. Pergerin, a hateful woman, that priest. An air of calm around her, but always a spiteful gleam in her eyes. Deimos shook his head. He didn't know Pergerin, but she had to be high order to warrant an audience with the Apex, even now with Euphraxia weakened. On top of his crate, Tolliver began to swing his legs and to hum softly to himself the way happy children did. Deimos had no idea how the boy could be happy down here in the stinking cellar, hidden away every day. And yet children had that magic in them. He hated to shush the boy, but he pressed a finger to his own lips. Tolliver shot him a grumpy look and crossed his arms, still swinging his legs.
Am I supposed to trust you? Euphraxia said, her voice rising with her ire, her words thus easier to discern.
What choice do you have? Pergerin replied.
You were there the first day, down below, helping the queen with rituals that are not hers to partake in. She blasphemes. She taints the magic of the gods. And you aided her.
The Silent murdered Ostvik before our eyes, and you know what became of his family. She threatened us with the same.
Cowards, all of you. What's your own life, the lives of your parents, your sisters, compared to the price of blasphemy? You know the stories, you've seen the ruins, you've read the words on the wall of the four.
Apex, please listen. I am with you. The priesthood is fractured now, split in two by the queen's edict. Some are loyal to the crown and to Peristolo, who is abetting her every whim and giving her exactly what she desires. But others feel the same horror and fear that you do. The truth of magic is filtering out into the city in whispers. Tales of our rituals, and Fila's claims of seizing her birthright. Even among the novices at Yaris Teague, priests argue over this. But if I believe nothing else, I believe that magic is sacred. The royals may have the blood of the four in their veins, but it's the priests of the High Order who are the true heirs of the gods.
Silence fell, and for a moment Deimos pictured Euphraxia staring at the chimney. Somehow alerted to those eavesdropping on her. She couldn't know, of course, but the Apex and her priests spoke of magic, and though he'd scoffed all his life, Deimos could no longer wholly deny its truth. The Apex must have just been deliberating, for now Pergerin prodded her.
I swear to you, the woman said. I am loyal to the faith and to your leadership.
Tolliver began to hum again, and the heel of his swinging boot bumped the crate. Deimos froze, but Mouse scurried away from the chimney mouth and grabbed his ankles to still him. Tolliver shrugged and smiled. Deimos wanted to be angry with him, but could not manage it. Mouse glanced over her shoulder, but Deimos held up a hand to forestall any questions. Instead, he listened. When Euphraxia began speaking again, it was much more quietly. Carefully, Deimos poked his head into the chimney and listened to the soft echoes of the words above as they filtered down to him. They were words of treason, resistance, and allies they might find among the five great clans. She talked of who might land on the throne if Queen Fila could be toppled from it, whether she might be driven from Lartha, or if it might be best if she died in her sleep one moonless night. Deimos could barely breathe. His moment had arrived. Now surely he could earn Fila's favor and his own freedom. When Mirren learned that he'd saved the queen from treachery and murder, she'd insist that her sister free him. Heart pounding, face flushed, lungs tinged with spiza, he withdrew from the chimney mouth and turned to stare at Mouse and Tolliver. The boy's arrival here had been a gift.
and Deimos's thoughts began to race ahead. He'd send Tolliver out, get a message to a faithful cousin who would